from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Childhood in Ancient Greece and the Philosophy of Science, two conversations this week on Soundings. My guests are Mark Golden of the University of Winnipeg and Marjorie Green of the University of California at Davis. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Mark Golden about his new study of childhood in ancient Greece. Following that, a discussion with Marjorie Green about philosophy and biology. Here is Mark Golden.
I think one of the problems in the history of family and childhood in the last generation has been that every researcher wishes to find in his or her period a turning point in the development of the idea of childhood or the family or relations within the family. And I think each researcher has convinced himself and herself that they have done that. They don't usually convince outsiders. People move the time at which childhood developed further back in time, and they fool around with it, this part of Europe, that part of Europe. This seems to me to be more or less a vain enterprise, entertaining for the researcher, but not really leading to very much for people on the outside. I'm more interested in the kind of deep description of Athenian childhood in itself, and in particular, the way in which children are prepared to become adults within that society.
All right, so you're talking about the constances, the constant points in human nature early on, as it were. Give me some specific pegs to hang this investigation on. What are you looking at?
I think the main theme of my work is what we might call socialization or acculturation, the way in which communities try to recreate themselves through their children in their own image. I say try because communities very often fail to do this, both because communities themselves are very mixed on gender lines, on racial lines in some cases, on class lines, and because different institutions within the community have different interests of their own, and also because children resist being socialized.
All right, well, what would the Athenian Greeks have been after in the recreation through their children of some sort of social goals? What were they doing?
One of the things I'm most interested in is in discussing the child's life with his, and I'm talking about boys now, with his peers. What kind of community do children build among themselves and for themselves, both with adult supervision and to a fair degree outside adult supervision? So I'm looking at games, I'm looking at athletic competitions which were organized by adults, I'm looking at education which was partly formal, partly informal, I'm looking at various kinds of friendships, including erotic friendships. In all of these, I'm trying to discuss how much of a role children were able to play on their own and how much adults interfered with them, who the adults were who interfered, whether they were just their own fathers, their own parents, or people who were appointed by the community as a whole, and then I'm trying to decide what difference it made. In their own games, children were more or less left alone. The classical Athenians were interested in children's games, but they were just interested in them partly, I think, because they were so different from what went on in adult life. The names of some of these games, the verses that the children chanted in some of these games, sometimes do seem to be a kind of social commentary. For example, there is a kind of chase game, which is called Runaway Slave. The name clearly makes best sense.
Now, this goes all the way back to ancient Greece.
Yes.
All right, where slavery was an institution.
Exactly. The name makes better sense in a community where there is slavery. And for children to play the role not only of the chasers, which is the role they'll have when they grow up, but as the runaways, indicates to me at least that the possibility of playing with those roles existed in their minds. Mm-hmm. That you could not just be a slave owner, but you could also be a slave.
Now, Mark, you mentioned an erotic or a sexual dimension to the socialization of Greek children.
I'm thinking primarily of homosexual relationships between boys and young men, or even slightly older men, which were accepted and even encouraged among the Athenian elite, at least. In the absence of any formal and compulsory education system, this served in some ways to provide children with moral models.
Now we have what appears to be a paradox here, Mark Gold. In our society, to say that we would encourage homosexuality as a device for education will strike some of our listeners not only as strange, but downright perverse. immoral. How did the Athenians talk to themselves about this, justify it? How did they figure it out? What were they after?
Well, there are several answers to that. One is that it's inherently not disgusting. The second is that the structure of Athenian society was such that young boys around the age of puberty and after had restricted sexual outlets of other kind. Because of the social system of the Athenians, because of their attitude towards women, it was just not acceptable for a young boy to go date the daughter of an Athenian citizen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking primarily about boys, but I'm also interested in the difference within the society and within the Greek world as a whole. So I'm going to write a chapter about girls, a chapter about Sparta as a contrast to Athens, and a chapter in which I discuss some changes which take place mm-hmm. after the classical period.
Is the word sexism going to come into your vocabulary here as you write about little boys and little girls in ancient Greece?
Oh, it's very clear that the Athenian society was sexist. What's less clear is exactly what a sexist society means over time. Certainly it was a society in which girls were regarded as different and inferior in many ways, in which those differences were replicated in social structure and law and political forms and so on.
Inferior where? Biologically? They were ineducable? What was the basis for the discrimination?
Well, some theorists thought they were ineducable. Certainly Aristotle has more or less that view, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, they weren't educated out in the community. It didn't mean that they couldn't be educated within the home, but they didn't join in social life, either as little girls or as adult women, uh-huh. in the same way as males did.
Mark Golden, what does childhood in antiquity, what does it have to teach parents today? Are there lessons to be drawn across the centuries? Do you look at it in what practical psychological terms such as those?
I suppose the main lesson to learn from studying childhood is simply to take children and childhood seriously. I'd say that our society doesn't have to learn that lesson. Our society probably takes children too seriously in some ways.
Uh-huh.
We have a belief that every single thing that happens in a child's life is suddenly going to bloom and blossom and burgeon and be some meaningful factor in their adult life. And I think the ancients would have been surprised to hear that, and I'm not sure that it's necessarily the truth.
Well, what would the ancients have focused upon in the development of a child? Either specific experiences, larger sorts of intangible kinds of things that they, the Athenians, would say, aha, this is something that we have to pay attention to and when we're looking at our kids.
Athenians were very concerned with discipline. The Athenians, when they expressed themselves, viewed the child as being unruly, not unmanageable, but certainly hard to manage, very much like an animal in certain ways. And the theoreticians who talk about this stress time and time again that children have to pay attention and obey their parents, their teachers, and those their parents have put in charge of them.
Uh-huh.
The Greek doctors did recognize that there were certain syndromes and certain diseases which were more or less specific to childhood,
uh-huh.
and developed ways to treat them, perhaps not very successfully. They also noticed that there were certain times in a child's life which were critical for his or her health. Again, some of this is scientific, some of it is kind of magical,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that the Greek doctors had numerological theories about the importance of the number 7 and the number 40 and so on. So the 7th day and the 40th day were thought to be climactic days in terms of a child's development.
Mm-hmm.
So some of this might not meet our criteria for science, which I expect to change every week, but they certainly are the products of close observation and a sign of interest.
Mark Golden, let's talk about childhood in ancient Greece demographically. How long did people live? Did that make any difference in terms of the way these ancient Greeks looked at their kids?
Two good questions and two separate questions, I think. We can only estimate ancient life expectancy, but all our evidence is that it was quite low, perhaps 25 to 35 years
Goodness.
At birth.
Uh-huh.
But like most high mortality populations with a low life expectancy, what that means is that there was a tremendous mortality in the first few years of life, and that if you reach the age of 15, your chance of making our retirement age and older was fairly good.
So that would account for a lot of the concentration of energy on childhood, call it what you want, an institution, a social concern on the part of the ancient Greeks, just getting a kid through those early years.
Well, I agree with that. Many people don't. It's commonly suggested that in high mortality populations, especially those with very high infant mortality, that adults, in particular parents, simply cannot afford to invest as much energy into their children as we try to do in ours.
Confirm or deny for me, Mark Golden, these stories that I've heard about the ancient Greeks, the term is exposing their children. Now, this would be what, birth defects or too many kids, or what was going on there? Killing them, in effect.
Yes, certainly killing them. Certainly the Athenians and other Greeks had a legal right and felt that they had a moral right not to raise all the children who were born into their households. Hmm. The reasons they chose for rejecting a child are various. Birth defects would be one. Having a girl instead of a boy might
gender,
be another.
Yes, right.
Gender would certainly be one criterion. Having too many children, not being able to raise another one on your own economic terms, would be a third.
Is this to say that the Greeks looked on human life as cheap? Are we to judge them for this? Is that just too high and mighty of us to talk in those terms?
Oh, we should certainly judge them, but we should judge them accurately. Mm-hmm. Once a child was admitted into the family, to kill the child was murder.
Yeah.
To mistreat the child was badly thought of. In my mind, the analogy one should make is with abortion today. Uh-huh. A lot of research has been done on abortion today, and it seems to show that women who choose to abort a fetus do not do so because they are hostile towards children in general. Uh-huh. And such women in follow-up studies prove to be as good or even better mothers than women in the population as a whole.
All right, so this was abortion, what, simply moved forward in time by a few months rather than backward in time?
Yes, I think that's a fair way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. You would look, for instance, Mark Golden, at not just the so-called biggies, Plato and Aristotle, that sort of thing. You would be looking at really some rather obscure kinds of evidence as you look at childhood in ancient Greece, right?
Absolutely. The biggies, as you call them, are unfortunately misleading because they are exceptional. What one wants to find is sources who represent common Athenian attitudes, and that's very difficult to do. Perhaps the best of all sources are the comic stage and the orations of the orators, the so-called orators who gave law court speeches based on divorce and squabbles over family property and so on. They don't say that much about children, and in a sense, that in itself may be significant. But what they do say is always interesting and valuable.
Mark Golden is a professor of classics at the University of Winnipeg. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Mark Golden worked on a study of childhood in ancient Greece. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a conversation about philosophy and science. My guest is Marjorie Green, a professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of California at Davis.
Philosophers need something to get their teeth into, their minds into, and biologists or other scientists or other specialists of all kinds, and sometimes plain ordinary people, but in this case, people in a given profession, sometimes can use the, I don't want to say help, but the cooperation of someone whose job is just to talk and things through and who doesn't know anything in particular about anything. There are always, in the relation between philosophy and any given discipline, and particularly with biology, which is what I've worked most with in this kind of in-between area, there are always two directions you can go. Either, as I just suggested a minute ago, the philosopher can help, can try to help clarify some areas in the science in question, or the other way around, the philosopher can learn something for his or her problems from the science. And in biology, it goes both ways. My interest, I suppose, has been chiefly in the former direction, that is, where you come and look at some of the basic principles, say, of evolutionary theory, the concept of adaptation, the concept of what gets called fitness, the question of what teleological explanation is, if anything, in biology and so on. In the case of biology, as I said, one can either try to clarify some conceptual muddles in the science, or one can see what one learns as a philosopher from the science. For instance, I think the fact of evolution makes a tremendous difference to the way one approaches, say, the problem of free will.
All right, let's pause on that for a moment.
Yeah.
When we talk about one of the charges, for instance, against the theory of evolution is the whole question of determinism, free agency, free will. Run with that for a moment. Help me to understand why the philosophers can say something interesting and helpful to people who have a difficulty with evolution.
They aren't on this question. They aren't necessarily professional philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
Ernst Mayr is a very great evolutionary biologist, gave the Messenger Lectures at Cornell a couple of years ago. The last one, which is now just being published in a new book of his about philosophy of biology, actually, is on ethics and freedom. And I think he did a pretty good job, better than most scientists do on this. But my own view, again, which is very much influenced by both my undergraduate training as a zoologist and longtime reading in evolutionary theory and by my experience of more than 20 years as a farmer, both in Illinois and then in Ireland, all of this has led me to take a view of the problem of freedom, which is very much biologically based.
Oh, it's refreshing to hear that I'm talking to a philosopher who's got some dirt underneath her fingernails.
Oh, lots. I didn't know I had it today, but I have had it in the past. But the point is that I think once you recognize, now I'm not the only person to have said this, nor is Mayr. There was an article by the professor of zoology at Liverpool many years ago called Pumphrey, called The Evolution of Thinking, in which I think he put the point very well. Once you can, I'll get back to him in a minute. Once you consider that some animals have a lot more flexibility within what their genetic program gives them than others and make use of their experience more actively than others. Once you recognize that, then you can see that in our case, needing to live within a culture, which is both artifactual because it's made by the conventions of a particular society, but natural to us so that we need it in order to develop. Within this kind of situation, there is for us a greater degree of freedom, so to speak, than there is for, say, a digger wasp making its nest.
All right. Now, when you talk about degrees of freedom, Marjorie Green, you use you also use an expression, genetic programming.
Right.
Are you precluding free will, free agency?
No, not at all. I'm saying that some animals have more degrees of freedom within what their genetics allows. We have a new dependence in that we need a culture. I don't know whether there are yet any examples of wild children really authenticated.
Yeah.
But insofar as one knows about this at all.
We hear them every 10 or 15 years.
And from actually what is known about children, babies in institutions and so on, it's clear that the human infant needs a family, needs the framework of a human world in which it comes to itself.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just get back to the point Humphrey made that I wanted to quote. I hope I have him right. He said, there is no such thing as holy bond or holy free, there are only degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But there are degrees of freedom, and within the context of biology, I think one can see them particularly well. And that's all one needs.
Mm-hmm.
That's one point. That in terms of evolutionary theory and the acceptance of a modern evolutionary biology, one can see very well what it means by freedom, namely one's own responsibility within one's niche to make what one can of it. But the other point that people neglect who think that somehow religion gives you freedom and science doesn't is this. The problem of free will only became a problem with Christianity. And when you carry the Christian message through to its logical conclusion, you haven't any freedom. I've just been reading a very brilliant account by a French critic writer about Descartes, about Pascal, who makes this entirely plain. God is the source of everything. There is no logical, coherent way to have a doctrine of freedom if you're a Christian.
Mm-hmm. You're back to predestination, like it or
yes,
not.
Yes, that's right. Everything comes from God. Whereas in the light of evolution, in the light of what we know of the biological scene, mm-hmm. that's a perfectly reasonable view of freedom. It's always paradoxical. Right. You can always find causes if you look for them. But nevertheless, there's an area there in which you can reasonably be held responsible.
All right, let's pursue these two threads. Does there always have to be, again, a necessary tension between religion as a manifestation of culture and science or biology when we talk about whether we've got freedom, whether we do not have freedom?
I don't think so. But there is a necessary tension between a simple-minded science, which says it's all determinism, mm-hmm. and on the one hand, and a simple-minded religiosity on the other, fundamentalism, which says it's all determined by God. Now, my point was simply, maybe I don't see that as quite a clean dichotomy, because I think that if you take the metaphysic underlying Christianity seriously, you can't have a doctrine of freedom. If you look at Leibniz or the great philosophers who tried to resolve this dilemma, they couldn't.
History is a great scroll unraveling itself, and God somehow or other knows exactly where it's all headed.
Well,
And therefore we're devoid of our agency.
It's not only just that. It isn't so much history.
Uh-huh.
That's going the causal way again.
Right.
It's the fact that the being of everything comes from God. Everything that is positive comes from God. Therefore, everything I do, except insofar as it's evil and therefore negative, mm-hmm. comes from God. And
right.
so I don't do anything.
All right. Now, let's get personal for a moment here, mm-hmm. Marjorie Greene. Does that make you an atheist? I mean, where do you place yourself on the philosophical spectrum when we come to questions of passionate questions about belief and origins and agency?
No. In the first place, please don't confuse belief, agency, and origin. The question
right.
of agency is one question, the question of origin is another. But no, the point is that a strict literal-minded Christianity mm-hmm. leads to the denial of free will if it's honest.
Mm-hmm.
And any way not to get the denial of free will is hedging. But that doesn't mean that because this is a consequence, you therefore become an atheist.
Uh-huh.
It means that there are different kinds of religiosity.
Yeah.
I think there is a very deep need in human beings as such to worship, which means basically to recognize that there is something in reality that transcends our grasp, our scope. So it's a question of the source of your beliefs, not just the source, the authority for your beliefs, and a question of the openness, not in the sense that anybody has a totally open mind, that's impossible, but in the sense that you take a position such that new knowledge will come about because of it. That's what Darwin said explicitly in the closing chapters of The Origin. He hoped that, given his view, because it undercut dogmatism about what a species is,
right,
people would be able to look for a lot of new knowledge and not always be worrying whether this particular creepy crawly gave you a good species or
not. So he didn't think of it. Darwin himself, it's not right to think of Darwin as creating somehow or other a threat to our cultural, the whole idea of belief and the idea of the supernatural or the transcendent.
Again, that's a very complicated question to answer because I don't think he posed such a threat.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of evolutionists who didn't think he posed such a threat, but I think he thought so.
All right. Let's conclude our conversation, Marjorie Greene. I remember meeting with one of the philosophers here at the Humanities Center who got on an airplane one day, sits next to a person, strikes up a conversation. The other person says, "What do you do for a living?" And he said, "Well, I'm a philosopher." And there was a pause, and the individual said, "Well, tell me some of your sayings." All right. Now, what I'm going to put to you is the same question. Talk to me for a moment about this old chestnut of the importance, the relevance of philosophy in our workaday world at the end of the 20th century. I mean, you're off in an ivory tower? No, not exactly. Here you're telling me you've been a farmer for 20 years as well as a professor of philosophy. Why is it important? Why are you passionate about it, not only individually, but socially?
You ask such difficult questions. First of all, I'm very cynical about my profession in a lot of ways.
You are.
If you're committed to it, there are areas in which it seems very important, given the presuppositions, the beliefs that will allow you to think it important. One is the history of philosophy, in which wonderful things are happening. I do believe that we are our history, and that if we want to understand ourselves, we need to understand where we've come from, and where we've come from in terms of Western thought is partly from the great philosophers of the past. So the really fine work that's being done in various periods in the history of philosophy seems to me very important, just if one's interested in intellectual matters at all. It's not practical. It doesn't keep us from electing bad presidents and things like that. But it's, you know, just in itself, it's important for self-knowledge of us as late 20th century Americans and Western Europeans as we are. But if you're really keen on what you consider to be philosophy, then there just is no stopping you. There's one other thing about it. It's a wonderful undergraduate teaching subject. Mm-hmm.
Marjorie Green is a professor emeritus at the University of California at Davis. Marjorie Green is the author of books about philosophy and biology, existentialism, and Aristotle. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Ask for program number 419. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. That's program number 419. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about terrorism and international politics. My guests will be Franklin Ford of Harvard University and Charles Townsend of the University of Kiel. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in October marks the anniversary of the death in 1806 of Benjamin Banneker, the astronomer and mathematician who came to be known as the first black man of science. The second week in October also marks birthdays for Giuseppe Verdi, the Italian composer who was born in 1813, and for Mason Locke Weems, the American clergyman and bookseller whose fables include the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. Weems was born in 1759. Finally, the second week in October marks a birthday for the White House in the nation's capital, where the cornerstone was put into place in October 1792. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Childhood in Ancient Greece and the Philosophy of Science. Two conversations this week on Soundings. Listen for Mark Golden of the University of Winnipeg and Marjorie Green of the University of California at Davis. Mark Golden is at work on a study of childhood in ancient Greece. Marjorie Green is the author of books about Aristotle and philosophy and biology. Ancient Childhood and the Philosophy of Science. Some answers and insights next on Soundings.